KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and Jared Farmer joins us in studio. He's a former Californian who now teaches history at Stony Brook University and is the author of On Zion's Mount, which is a nonfiction winner of the Parkman Prize, and has a new book out, which is a California history book called Trees in Paradise, which shows us the history of the Golden State through its trees. And welcome, Jared Farmer. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You've picked essentially four trees here. You could have picked probably a lot of others, but why these four?
Why these four? Well, four seems like a good number. It's somewhat arbitrary, but lots of books have four things. I definitely had to do the biggest, oldest of the native California trees. So I chose sequoias and redwoods. They're different species and genera, but
they've been put together.
I put them together because they have very similar histories. And then I had the choice, do I do more native or not? I decided to go with three non-natives, in part because the majority of Californians are non-native, if you want to think of it that way. They come from somewhere else or have relatively shallow roots. And so I decided I needed one that was like economic plant, one that was a symbolic one, and the one that was definitely urban, because I wanted to cover all parts of the state, or at least as many as I could, north to south from the coast of the Sierra. So when it came to economic plants, I mean, I considered almonds, I considered olives, you know, apricots. There's a new apricot book about Silicon Valley or what used to be there. But oranges I decided to focus on because there's no other tree in the history of California that matches it in terms of economic importance.
All started in Riverside, in fact. I learned from your book. I learned a lot from your book, I must say. In fact, what's fascinating about this book is that this was a pretty treeless place when you go back to its history in the early stages. And we have more trees now than we ever had since the Pleistocene era.
That's true. Yeah, that's surprising to a lot of Californians. Of course, we had the amazing redwood forest. But if you think of the lowland parts of California, like below 2,000, especially 1,000 feet, the Central Valley, the Piedmont of the Bay Area, Southern California, very few trees historically. I mean, there were oaks, of course, streamside trees, but it was much more marked by grasslands, wetlands, marshes. It was incredibly biologically rich, you know, full of people, you know, grizzlies in the lowland, tule elk, migratory birds by the millions. It was not a wasteland by any stretch of the imagination, but not very tree covered, kind of like the Great Plains, not many trees, but an incredible place of wildlife. And so if you think about what Californians in the American period did, they staged a landscape revolution with trees, which came with great ecological consequences, not all good. There's good and the bad, and tremendous social and economic transformations that came with this importation, this planting of millions and millions of trees in lowlands parts of the states where you just didn't have many trees before.
There were a lot of those people who came west and essentially had a kind of arborist mentality about them. But, of course, planting trees was also economically sound, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the American East was, of course, incredibly wooded from a European point of view. Think of the colonists. They were just astounded by the forests of the East. And Americans got very used to unthrifty wood use and famously sort of blaze through, burn through, clearing the eastern forest. They got to the west and they were puzzled by places like California, which seemed so rich, biologically beautiful weather, climate, but not many trees. The Central Valley seemed like this bipolar wasteland because it was a desert that flooded every spring. And they wanted to, what they would call it, improving the wastelands or reclaiming or imparadising. There were a set of words in the 19th century people used. And they wanted to, you know, cure malaria, improve the climate, improve society. There were all these ideas about how you could make the world better by bringing more trees in.
The pivotal time that we're talking about in terms of bringing more trees in, of course, was the Gold Rush.
The Gold Rush a little bit after.
So 1848, I guess.
Yeah, so 1848 is the year that, you know, U.S. vanquishes Mexico in a war of aggression. And literally weeks later, you have gold discovered. And my main characters are not Gold Rush people. They came just slightly after, and they were often horrified by the Gold Rush and by the waste of resources and sort of like the greediness on display. And they sort of thought that by bringing in trees, you can inspire a different kind of California that would be less about, you know, young men looking for lucre, but more about families, especially white families. These were often racist people, but they wanted to have kind of small floral sort of estates where you'd have families and sort of a stable economy, and were just delighted when they figured out you could grow all these Mediterranean fruits and nuts in California that you really couldn't do anywhere else in America. So if they could figure out how to tap into Eastern markets, which was a huge, you know, economic challenge, but if you could do that, then this would be a major economic driver. And it was in the long run. I would argue that, you know, if you're talking about decades, that horticulture was as important as the gold rush in the development of California. I mean, before aerospace and Hollywood and tech, I mean, horticulture really was one of the key economic drivers of the Golden State.
Well, and you mentioned the racism. I mean, it's fascinating to read, and appalling in many ways, you know, about the lazy Spaniards, you know, who didn't do enough arboreal work or planting of trees or horticultural work. But also, even when you get into something like the eucalyptus trees, I mean, these are invasive aliens. I mean, it almost like I guess you draw a distinction, a dichotomy between looking at eucalyptus trees that way as opposed to naturalized citizens.
Yeah, I mean, eucalyptus is a very interesting story because there's no other tree in California that was so loved and then so hated, like this amazing fall from grace. And what you're talking about is like this backlash since especially the 80s in the Bay Area, especially since 91 and the Berkeley Hills fire. And you have a minority of kind of eucalyptophiles, people who love trees, old trees, especially eucalyptus trees, who defend them and often claim without much evidence, honestly, that people who want to restore certain parts of the California habitat that had grasses more than trees or want to kind of remove fire hazards are engaging in a kind of, you know, veggie racism or botanical xenophobia. And sometimes say that, well, you know, scientists talk about invasive species or, you know, exotic or foreign species, which is true. But and at some like deep semantic level, there might be some connections between, you know, these kinds of xenophobia, and I put that in scare quotes. But I think often it's more of like a rhetorical move. And this is still a live issue here in San Francisco, especially with Mount Sutro. But I want to point out that there's a lot of middle ground here. I want to say since the 80s, there's been a kind of, I think, consensus about the belongingness of eucalyptus trees in California. And it's somewhat perplexing. This is still such a contentious issue.
Well, you mentioned, you know, bringing in trees because of trying to improve weather or to defeat malaria or all that sort of thing. That's particularly true for those fast-growing Australian eucalyptus. What do they call them? Tasmanian blue gum?
Tasmanian blue gum, which is the eucalyptus tree you're most likely to see in the Bay Area. It's the ones that grows in the Berkeley Hills in Marin County in Golden Gate National Recreation Area. It was one of the most colonial trees in the history of the modern world. You find it all throughout the British Empire, India, South Africa, and the French Empire. It was really popular because it grew incredibly fast. It was the fastest growing hardwood in the world. And in California, it grew even faster, preternaturally fast, because it was an Australian-like environment, but there were no bugs or diseases or koalas or anything else that fed on eucalyptus here. So they grew to like sequoia-like size in 50 years, just incredible. And so they did sort of fill the Oakland niche because California is just wasted, devastated the oaks of Oakland and other areas. And so they brought in these trees for a bunch of reasons, but one was for firewood, for railroads, and then later for kind of speculative reasons. So Tasmanian blue gum, they're kind of messy, big, magnificent. They're almost as messy as like the female ginkgo in their own way. They shed a lot of bark. They're very aromatic. I'm sure all your listeners know them by sight and smell. And there were hundreds of eucalyptus species tried in California, but that's the one that was probably 90% used and is the one most common here. And in a few areas of California, it's moderately invasive. The fog belt of the Central Coast, the Bay Area being one of them. But for the most part, eucalyptus trees, including Tasmanian blue gum, are not invasive. It's just that they were so popular. They were so desirable. So when you see something like the Berkeley Hills, it's not as if those trees like took over the landscape. It's like that was a plantation. People planted them in even rows because they thought they could make a buck. And then later, those companies went bankrupt and we were left with former plantations that became suburbs. So it's sort of it's a historical legacy. It's not like a legacy of bioinvasion.
They become the word that's often used is profligate.
Yeah.
We're talking, by the way, with Jared Farmer, who's author of Trees in Paradise, A California History, and you learn all about California history through its trees. In fact, you know, we talk about the sequoias or the redwoods. You know, you used to listen to me back when you were a Californian, you said before we went on the air, and maybe you heard some of the programs we did about the big fights over the redwoods and essentially, you know, and we've got different redwoods now as a result of all of that, don't we?
Now, what do you mean by that?
I mean, it's a different breed, really, of redwoods. I mean,
it's a different forest, that's what you mean. I mean, it used to be you know, one of the grandest forests on Earth. Then by 1900, it was 100% privately owned. There was no other species of tree, I think, in the world that was under 100% private control. And then basically almost all the old growth was clear cut. And then very expensively, very contentiously, pockets of these old growth stands were saved, you know, from the 19-teens and 20s up through the early aughts of this century. So what you have now is like big areas of privately owned second, third growth redwood trees.
Which is what I meant.
Yeah, exactly. Which are kind of...
No, they're different.
They're different. Yeah. It's not the same forest. And then you have these like little pocket parks of old growth, which are also kind of unnatural because like you have these little stationary pockets that aren't big enough to manage as a real forest ecologically. They can be quite vulnerable to flood damage because they tend to be riparian. So if you look at a satellite image of like Humboldt County, it's very clear the difference between these kind of pockets of old growth and then these second, third growth redwoods that... the forest has regenerated. We have more redwoods today than a century before. Yeah. There are no danger of going extinct, but it is a completely different forest. You're right.
And what we say, I mean, you write about the eucalyptus, the redwoods are sequoias, and also palm trees and citrus trees. And a lot of Southern California, of course, has been identified with citrus trees, and a lot of the urban areas with palm trees, particularly Los Angeles. And so there's a lot of that history. But what I didn't had any no idea about. Disneyland, I mean, built on 1,600 acres of Orange Ranch, essentially.
Yeah.
Because it's in Orange County, right? Thank you, Irene. But 4,000 of these Valencia trees had to be bulldozed and uprooted, forbid for Disneyland.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's not a single commercial orange grove left in Orange County. There's not a single grove, period, in Los Angeles County outside of the Huntington Gardens. There's a little relic grove that's just quite diseased and it's probably going to have to be torn out soon. Orange County in the 1950s was just one bulldozed walnut and also avocado, but especially Valencia orange grove after another. Huge bonfires until the air quality board stopped that. You know, up until like the very day they stopped that, there were just enormous piles of orange trees being burned up. They didn't know what to do with all these dead trees. They would try to dump them in reservoirs or... It was too much to mulch. They just couldn't use them. They burned them. So after, you know, World War II, which was the peak of the Southern California orange industry, it was the number one crop in America, the number one crop in California, more important than aerospace at that moment. But almost immediately after World War II, when you have the housing boom, it becomes cheaper to grow these trees in the Central Valley. So what you have over a 20-year period is this massive transplantation of capital and also tree stock from, you know, Riverside, Orange, L.A. counties, to Tulare and Fresno counties, which is the new citrus belt. California still has lots of citruses, and it's a huge industry, but it's all in the Central Valley.
But the irony in a lot of this is that the oranges and the palms are not really suited for California soil or weather.
Well, no, orange is a subtropical plant. It evolved in Southeast Asia. I mean, to grow in California, you have to have this incredible reclamation infrastructure, you know, dams and aqueducts and canals. I mean, you're basically growing a subtropical plant in a semi arid or even desert environment if you go to the Imperial Valley. So the only reason why this makes sense economically is that the oranges are beautiful here in a way that they're not beautiful anywhere else in the world. I mean, beautiful on the outside. That kind of even orange appearance you get on a navel orange, you only get that in kind of a thermal zone where you have these temperature variations by day. Basically, you need cool temperatures to get the nice orange exterior. If you get an orange in Brazil or Florida, it's going to be mottled and kind of ugly on the outside. So California oranges, I mean, they do taste good.
They're prettier.
They're just prettier.
Yeah.
And so if you think about it, this is incredible, you know, billions and billions of dollars poured into this enterprise just to grow pretty fruit.
Talking again with Jared Farmer, who's the author of Trees in Paradise. And let me just get back for a moment to the redwoods because couldn't help thinking, you know, back about those redwood wars over, timber companies and environmentalists. But logging the redwoods really drove the economy, too, as you point out.
You think about, you know, housing starts in California from the gold rush up through about year 2000. I mean, redwoods kind of fueled the California dream of home ownership. All those bungalows in Berkeley, those are all made of redwood.
Bungalows
John Muir's house
in
Martinez made of redwood. Even like modernist homes in the South Bay and LA made of redwood. This was basically an all-California resource. It was made in California, used, wasted, misused, all in California, because it was only grown here. And until the Transcontinental Railroad hooked up to the North Coast, which wasn't until about 1914, about the same time as the Panama Canal, it was really only made sense to use it in California. So Californians use it for everything. This is the best wood in the world, like bar none. But we used it for, you know, pencils and grape stakes and shingles and toys and coffins. There were, you know, thousands and thousands of Californias that were buried in, you know, old growth heartwood from redwood trees, like up through like the 1950s. It was just this incredible waste of a resource. Now it's very scarce, of course, and it's premium wood, which it always should have been. But the problem is there was all of this, you know, merchandise on the market and nowhere to take it. You could take it a little bit to Hawaii, and it would show up in the mines of like Arizona and Alaska because it was terrific for delivering irrigation or for sewer systems. Like San Francisco's original municipal water supply system was all redwood pipes. Like original Hetch Hetchy water came through pipes. And so in some parts of the West, you see that in the mine countries, like in Utah. But for the most part, this was a California resource made and wasted right here at home.
And since we're talking about California history and the trees, and mainly these four species of trees, considering redwoods and sequoias as one species, even though there are two, and
yeah,
palm trees, eucalyptus, citrus. When you talk about citrus trees, it's connected in California history with a lot of social inequality, with a lot of racial injustice, obviously, but also with a lot of environmental pollution. And you get into something that I think a lot of people either don't acknowledge or are unaware of, and that is we're not just talking about greed with a lot of the problems that have resulted. There have been a lot of problems that have resulted related to trees because of naturalists, because of environmentalists, I mean, well-intentioned perhaps, mm-hmm, and because of government.
Yeah, I mean, trees, I think, are a wonderful way to understand history because people love trees. I've never met a person who has this categorical hatred or disdain for trees, but people get in enormous fights over trees.
And some people hate the eucalyptus, I think.
Yes, or maybe not. Categorically hate eucalyptus, but not all trees. And trees can be, you know, sources of great wealth, but also sources of great inequality. You're right that, you know, the history of the California farm worker, I mean, from basically the 1850s to the present, is one of exploitation. And maybe it was better to be a citrus picker than a strawberry picker or a cotton picker. Probably it was. But this is still, you know, kind of race-based labor discrimination. There were, you know, horrible instances of strike breaking, especially in Orange County in the 1930s. You know, Kerry McWilliams, you know, compared it to, you know, fascism. You know, there was essentially Jim Crow in Southern California with, you know, Mexican, before that was Japanese, before that Chinese, before that indigenous Californians. But they were often segregated into like different parts of town, had different shops, different, you know, pools. So, you know, we wax nostalgic about the old orchard landscapes. You know, apparently Steve Jobs, you know, had this vision of having in the center of the, you know, the spaceship in Cupertino, this big glass enclosure, like a new apricot orchard, because he misses the old.
You talk to people who grew up in that area, and they
right.
constantly talk
and
about
the same
it,
thing in Redlands or Riverside. But, you know, these weren't innocent landscapes. They were very beautiful, probably more beautiful than warehouses and, you know, strip malls. But, you know, they were places full of, you know, horrible smudging, a kind of pollution that came from heating orchards in the wintertime with crude oil, basically just buckets of oil lit on fire, all sorts of pesticides. And again, lots of labor exploitation. So I'm not sure if I miss it the same way. And when I think of like the glass enclosure in Cupertino, I sort of think of it as like the new hyper secular version of the California Mission with its garden enclosure. But now we have this, it'll be like this make-believe apricot and apple orchard for the neophytes at Apple. And I don't know how I feel about that. I think it's a dangerous kind of nostalgia.
There's a lot of nostalgia just about trees. You know, if you think about Johnny Appleseed and Paul Bunyan, I mean, it's warp and woof of our mythic American notions. But also, you know, when you're talking about pretty trees, you're talking about pretty oranges and also most of the glamour comes down to palm trees. Most of the, you know, the L.A. and Hollywood and all that, it's all palm trees.
Right.
I mean, it's maybe like they say, I think it was Oscar Levin who said, about Hollywood under the tinsel is more tinsel, you know. But we're also struck by the fact that, you know, this is associated with something that's pretty again, aesthetically pleasing.
Right. There's no other state that has promoted itself with trees like California. I mean, citrus and palms especially. I mean, we sell our state to tourists that way, but also I think we have internalized that we come to California in part because we want trees flowering in the winter and we want to have an avocado and a lemonade in our backyards. And L.A. did invent a new association with palm trees, and that is like trees that are associated with a city, you know, not like the
urban
seaside
trees.
Resort, but,
yeah.
but an urban tree that yeah. also has associations with glamour and celebrity and sex. But that's actually quite recent. I want to say that's really from the golden age of Hollywood on. If you go to, say, circa 1900, Sacramento has far more palm trees than L.A., San Diego, Santa Barbara, even San Francisco, I would say, had more kind of professionally manicured landscape palms as of 1900. You know, all those Gilded Age robber baron types, they had palm trees on Nob Hill. There were palm trees put in Union Square right after the fire at the Palace Hotel by Union Square. They had a palm court. But the L.A. palm is a new kind of thing, this kind of sidewalk palm. It's this icon of verticality that matches the horizontality of the freeway that's associated with, you know, TV and cinema. If you live in LA, as I used to, you realize that there really aren't that many palm trees of that high sky duster type, the type that catches the last bit of sun before it drops into the Pacific, that is something we promote much more than we cultivate in reality. I mean, probably, you know, Irvine or even Riverside now. Certainly Sacramento has more beautiful palm trees than L.A., but L.A. sells its palm trees better than any city in the world.
We're talking again with Jared Farmer. His book is called Trees in Paradise. It tells the story of California through four main characters, the majestic redwood, the glamorous palm, the fragrant eucalyptus, and the colorful citrus tree. And we're talking about the state's trees and what they can tell us about culture and history. And Jared Farmer is Associate Professor of History at Stony Brook University. And here's a question from Paul. How can any discussion of the role of trees in California's history not include oaks, or does the author consider history to have only started with the Spanish conquest?
Well, that's a fair question. It's one I've received before. I mean, I do talk about oaks in the eucalyptus chapter, maybe in passing. That was very, very hard for me to not do oaks. I really wrestled with this, but here's my rationale. I mean, I do talk about Native Americans at length in the redwood section. There's so many kinds of California natives. You can't do everything. Even a book that's 500 pages long, you can't do everything. I leave out the Mojave Desert, the northwest parts of California. I was really committed ultimately to a story about conquest. And maybe that's old-fashioned, but I'm okay with that decision because this is telling a story of conquest in a new kind of way. Because I want to say the horticultural conquest of California, the greening of California, which is a legacy of conquest, is a part of the story we haven't told. And these millions of trees that now grow in the lowland parts of the state seem so beautiful and natural, but they have a history, and it's not an innocent history. And
how much of that is in Kevin Starr's work? I'm trying to go back in my mind because I've read a lot of his work.
I mean, he certainly talks about the oranges. But I want to say that's a book that needs to be written. There is a good kind of general book about oaks in California, but not a deep history, but something that goes from so early indigenous times through sudden oak death would be a wonderful book. I decided ultimately that eucalyptus trees kind of did the work I wanted oaks to do in my story, because I wanted a whole section of the book to kind of deal with the theme of belongingness and indigeneity and, you know, what does it mean to be native or non-native or immigrant in California. And ultimately, it was just a better story, honestly. It was like a storytelling decision. Eucalyptus trees arrive at a specific point in the 1850s after the gold rush, and there are all sorts of really dramatic, wonderful, often crazy historical figures associated with eucalyptus trees, which often filled in the Oakland niche where California's just wasted oaks. And so I kind of explore, I guess, the yin and yang of native, non-native by looking at the most famous non-indigenous tree. And so I'm very sensitive to this criticism. I can only say that I hope someone else writes that book. Oaks, Archman is important. I love them too. And we should, plant more oaks and tend them. And of course, Native American history is very important. But again, you can't do everything.
Well, here's just for the record, a piece of criticism. Although Mary writes by beginning to say, begins and ends with nice words. She says, please thank Mr. Farmer for his excellent history of California's trees. For the record, he trivializes both the impact of and the public's concern about San Francisco's Natural Areas Program. This program has destroyed thousands of healthy trees and plans to destroy 18,500 more trees, as well as untold numbers of trees under 15 feet tall. The public is also very concerned about the large quantities of herbicides that are used to kill non-native vegetation and poison the roots of the trees that are destroyed so they don't resprout. But thanks to KQED for inviting Mr. Farmer and for his fine history of California's trees.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the eucalyptus battles are ongoing here in the Bay Area. This has been going on since the 80s. I mean, your listeners may remember the Angel Island controversy. Part of the problem why this keeps happening again and again in the Bay Area, there's so many jurisdictions. I mean, you have California Parks, you have the Presidio Trust, you have the National Park Service with the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, you have National Wildlife Refuges, you have the UC system, you know, Berkeley and UC San Francisco, and you have the city of San Francisco with its parks. And then there's a division within the parks, which is the National Parks program, which are acreages within the city's control that have been designated for restoration. And yes, they have removed many eucalyptus trees. Sometimes they do spray Roundup on them because eucalyptus can regenerate, kind of like redwood, from the stump. And sometimes, actually the Sierra Club supports this, sometimes you have to use things like Roundup to kill them. I mean, I think reasonable people can disagree on this. I mean, I think even people who want to restore grassland or dune environments in the Bay Area have a visceral reaction. We see an old tree cut down, and, you know, it kind of hurts to see that. But again, I think there's a lot of middle ground here. Eucalyptus trees, I want to say, belong in some parts of California, and they don't belong in others. And it depends on context. And I would love to see them planted more in certain kind of, you know, rural campus highway locations. We don't have to use the same Tasmanian blue gum. We don't even use that anymore. We use smaller ones, less messy, less flammable versions. It is a part of California heritage, and I think they're beautiful. And I am willing to defend eucalyptus trees conditionally. But in places like, you know, Mount Sutro or above Berkeley, the UC Berkeley, I mean, they are a fire hazard. And again, I think tree lovers can, I think, find a reasonable middle ground. And in fact, if you look at Angel Island, I think we sort of achieved that in the 80s, you know, sort of a recognition that some eucalyptus trees are a part of California heritage, should be preserved, and in other areas they should be removed. And the Presidio has done much the same, but again, after these cycles of controversy that go on and on.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was historian Jared Farmer, talking about his new book, Trees in Paradise, about the rich flora that makes up California, specifically the redwood, the palm, the eucalyptus, and the citrus tree. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum up ahead on this Memorial Day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.